So think about it like this. If you want to learn how to, drive a car, you don't turn on the TV, watch a Formula One race, and just assume those rules apply to your local grocery store parking lot.
Right, yeah, that would be a disaster.
I mean, you wouldn't watch the Monaco Grand Prix to figure out how to parallel park, or assume you're legally allowed to drive 200 miles an hour just because you saw Max Verstappen do it on a Sunday.
Exactly.
But the crazy thing is, every single day, adults decide they want to get into ice hockey. And they do exactly that. They fire up a stream of an NHL game, they watch the systems, they study the penalties, they go online to buy a stick, and then they just drive down to their local rink, assuming they actually understand the landscape. And according to the stack of sources we're diving into today, that person has just made like a series of massive foundational mistakes before they've even laced up their skates.
Yeah, it really is a fascinating disconnect. It is the absolute definition of jumping into the deep end without checking if there's actually water in the pool first. By using the NHL as your baseline, you arrive at the local rink having bought gear you might not actually be allowed to wear. You've memorized a rule book that, statistically speaking, probably doesn't apply to the specific sheet of ice you're standing on.
Wow, right?
And, perhaps most critically, you've assumed that the rink itself is just a passive building rather than a highly specific bureaucratic entity that essentially dictates your entire reality in the sport.
And that disconnect is exactly why we are taking this deep dive today. So, welcome everyone to a masterclass on the hidden structures of ice hockey. Our mission right now isn't to tell you how to shoot a puck or, how to execute a perfect crossover.
Right, there are 1,000 tutorials online for that stuff.
Exactly. Our goal is to help you build a complete, integrated mental model of how this sport actually operates behind the scenes. We want to show you how to navigate its entryways without getting hurt, without wasting a ton of money, and let's be honest, without making a fool of yourself in the dressing room.
Which is very easy to do, by the way.
Oh, totally. So we're going to decode the unwritten rules, the localized mandates, and the surprisingly complex bureaucracy of the local rink.
Okay, let's unpack this ecosystem. Because from the outside looking in, if you're a casual fan, hockey just looks like this chaotic, fast-paced free-for-all.
Right, just organized chaos.
Yeah, but when you actually read through the administrative sources, the rule books, and the governance structures, it is a highly structured, locally administered matrix of rules, insurance policies, and really strict etiquette.
It is very much an invisible matrix. And to build our mental model here, we have to start with the very first thing you must understand, which is how the sport is actually governed. Because hockey is not a monolith.
Right.
There is no single universal hockey authority sitting in a tower dictating everything for everyone everywhere. Which brings us back to that Formula One analogy. Watching the NHL to learn the rules for your local rink is, well, it's your first trap. The NHL is a professional, closed-circuit entertainment league. Your local Tuesday night drop-in game is governed by a completely different set of layers, and the sources actually outline four distinct layers of governance that stand between you and the ice.
Let's break those layers down logically, starting from the very top. So at the peak of the pyramid, you have the International Federation layer. This is the IIHF, the International Ice Hockey Federation.
Okay.
They're essentially the United Nations of hockey. They have 84 member associations globally, 61 full members, and 23 associate members. And their primary function is to set the global
So they
baselines.
write the rules.
Yes, they write the primary rule book that is used everywhere outside of North American professional leagues, and they handle international play like the Olympics and the World Championships.
Yep.
But here is the critical thing to remember about the IIHF. They do not know who you are. They do not manage individual amateur players.
So it's like they write the Constitution, but they aren't the ones handing out the driving licenses.
Exactly. So to get your license, you drop down to the second layer, which is the National Governing Body, or NGB. If you are in the United States, this is USA Hockey. In Canada, it is Hockey Canada. In Britain, it is Ice Hockey UK.
Okay, that makes sense.
This layer is crucial because they handle the heavy administrative lifting. This is the entity that processes your registration, negotiates your insurance, mandates coach and official certifications, and establishes safeguarding standards.
So when I pay that big annual membership fee,
A significant portion of that money is going directly to this national layer to purchase your legal and medical shield.
but even then, I mean, if I log on to USA Hockey or Hockey Canada and pay my fee, they still aren't the ones telling you what time my game is on Tuesday night, right?
No, they absolutely aren't. And this is a super common point of frustration for beginners. They pay their national fee and say, okay, where do I go?
Right, they show up looking for a game.
Exactly. So for that, we drop down again. Often there is a third layer, the region or district. USA Hockey, for instance, is massive, so it divided into 12 geographical districts containing 34 affiliates. They handle the regional governance, disputes, state-level tournaments, that kind of thing.
Between the national body and your local club.
Right. But the fourth layer, the foundational layer, is the local association, the club, or the rink itself.
And here's where it gets really interesting, because that bottom layer is the one that actually impacts your daily physical reality. They are the ones who set your season fees. They set your ice schedule. They decide the names of the divisions and tiers you actually play in. They manage the rosters.
Yes, the daily stuff.
The sources explicitly point out that while the national body's website will explain what registration is conceptually, they will never tell you what your local season costs or which night you skate. You have to physically engage with the local rink for that.
Think of the local rink or club as a franchise operating under the umbrella of those higher layers. The IAHF writes the baseline rules, the NGB provides the insurance and framework, but the local franchise dictates your daily reality.
So if we're building a mental model, the rule of thumb here is, if you want to understand the framework of the game, you look up the chain to the national or international bodies. But if you want to know how much money to bring, what time to show up, and what color jersey to wear, who do you ask?
You ask the local layer. You talk to the person at the front desk of the rink, or you email the local club registrar.
Precisely. And the danger of not understanding these layers is that administrative structures change. Our sources detail a massive structural earthquake that recently happened in one specific region, and it perfectly illustrates why you cannot just rely on a static web search or, like, an old forum post to understand your local governance. We need to look closely at what happened in the United Kingdom.
The British anomaly. Let's dig into this, because this isn't just bureaucratic trivia. It fundamentally altered how a player actually gets on the ice in that country.
Yeah, explain what happened.
It's a really fascinating case study in sports governance. Historically, hockey governance in Britain was heavily fragmented. You had England Ice Hockey, the EIH handling operations in England and Wales. Separately, you had Scottish Ice Hockey handling operations in Scotland.
Okay, so two different bodies on one island.
Right. And sitting above both of them, acting sort of as an international liaison, was Ice Hockey UK. It was inefficient, it caused friction, and it basically meant that a player moving from London to Edinburgh was essentially moving to a completely different governing jurisdiction.
Like moving to a different country, hockey-wise.
Exactly. But as of June 30th, 2026, that entire historical structure was wiped out.
Total hard reset.
The complete hard reset. On June 30th, 2026, Ice Hockey UK fully unified the governing bodies. England Ice Hockey and Scottish Ice Hockey effectively merged entirely into IHUK.
Wow.
It was a massive undertaking, making ice hockey Britain's first Olympic sport to fully consolidate its governance across all home nations, England, Northern Ireland, Scotland, and Wales.
Okay, so from a high-level organizational perspective, that sounds great. Synergy, efficiency, all those corporate buzzwords. But if I'm just a guy who wants to play in a beer league in Manchester, what is this historical context actually mean for me? Like, why does this matter to a beginner?
It matters because of the logistics of how a merger like that is executed. Because of this unification, Scottish Ice Hockey and England Ice Hockey literally wrote to their members terminating those existing memberships as of June 30th.
Wait, terminating them?
Terminating them. Well, every single player, coach, and official had to have a new IHUK membership created in its place. So imagine you are a beginner. You spent hours in May of 2026 researching how to join a league in Sheffield. You bookmarked the registration portal, you memorized the fees, you read a Reddit thread from 2025 explaining exactly how the EIH handles insurance.
And as of July 1st, 2026, every single thing I learned is entirely obsolete.
Completely obsolete. The organization that collects your fee changed, the portals changed, the entire landscape was rebuilt in the summer of 2026. This is why you must engage with your local club in real time.
All right, you can't just trust a Google search from 2 years ago.
No, you have to ask your local registrar, hey, who exactly am I registering with this season? You cannot assume continuity.
That is such a crucial lesson. The bureaucracy is a lying thing. And speaking of relying on the wrong information, let's circle back to that Formula One analogy and look at what actually happens on the ice. We need to talk about the rulebook reality.
Oh, this is perhaps the most common misconception for any new fan or player. Because hockey writing and media in English overwhelmingly default to the NHL, when you read a hockey blog, listen to a broadcast, or watch a YouTube tutorial, they are almost certainly assuming the NHL rulebook.
Naturally.
But if you play in Britain, or frankly, almost anywhere outside of North America, you do not play under the NHL rulebook. You play under the IIHF official rulebook, which is then further modified by local in-house rules.
We really need to break down exactly what that means physically, because these differences aren't just minor administrative tweaks, right? They fundamentally change the geometry, the tactics, and the safety of the game. Let's look at the physical ice surface first. When you watch the NHL, every single rink from New York to Los Angeles is strictly 200 feet long by 85 feet wide. It is absolute uniformity.
But the IIHF rulebook does not demand that uniformity. Rule 1.2 of the IIHF book permits any sheet of ice that is 60 meters long and anywhere between 26 and 30 meters wide.
Let's do the math on that because it's actually staggering. A variance between 26 meters and 30 meters is a variance of over 13 feet in width between two equally legal sanctioned rinks.
It is a massive difference. And to understand why it matters, we have to look at the mechanics of how the game is played. If you are playing on a wider 30-meter sheet, the corners of the rink are physically further away from the net.
Right.
The half wall, which is the section of the boards level with the face-off dots, is pushed much further away from the high-danger scoring area in the middle of the ice, which we call the slot.
So if I'm a defenseman, let's say I've spent a year playing on a narrow 26-meter rink. I've learned exactly how many strides it takes to get from the middle of the ice to the boards to cut off an attacker. I have my angles dialed in. Then my team travels to a rink across town that happens to be 30 meters wide.
Your defensive angles are completely ruined. You will take your standard three strides toward the boards, and the attacker will simply skate right around you because there is still 6 feet of open ice you didn't account for.
Wow, just dead space.
Exactly. Furthermore, a wider rink fundamentally changes how checking and body contact work. On a narrow NHL-style rink, you can angle an attacking player into the boards relatively quickly. Running a player out of room is a primary defensive tactic. On a 30-meter-wide rink, that attacker has a vast amount of open ice to evade you before they run out of room.
So the game is just more open.
Yeah, the geometry of your defensive systems has to adapt to the physical reality of the specific ice you are standing on.
It's incredible to think that you could be playing the exact same sport in the exact same league, but the physical environment shifts beneath your feet from week to week. And the sources note that in Britain, under their in-house rules, they even authorize rinks that are smaller than the 60-meter minimum for official fixtures. So the fundamental takeaway here is look at the sheet you are actually standing on, not a diagram from a book.
Exactly. You must adapt to your localized environment. Now, let's look at a rule difference that directly impacts gameplay face-offs. This is a significant change detailed in the most recent sources.
Right. Historically, face-offs have a bit of leeway. Two centers line up, and if one of them twitches or tries to cheat and win the draw early, the referee blows the whistle and issues a warning. They reset and try again.
That was true under the older 2025-2026 IIHF rules, but under the new 2026-2027 IIHF rules, that warning is gone.
Wait, gone entirely.
Entirely gone. If the offending team's center commits a face-off violation moving too early, not placing their stick correctly, they are immediately ejected from the face-off circle. There is no second chance. They are thrown out of the draw, and a winger has to step in and take it. The NHL does this, and now the IIHF has adopted it.
Think about the mechanics of that for a moment. You are a winger. You spend your entire practice working on digging pucks out of the corners or setting up in front of the net. You never practice face-offs. Suddenly, your center flinches, gets tossed by the referee, and you have to step into the circle in your own defensive zone, knowing that if you lose the draw cleanly, the other team gets a direct shot on your goalie.
Talk about pressure.
Right. You need to know that rule exists before it happens to you, so you can actually practice taking a draw just in case.
And this highlights another layer of bureaucratic complexity. The sources point out that the British in-house rules for the 26-27 season actually contradict themselves on their title page regarding which version of the IIHF book they are enforcing. In one section, they claim to adopt the older 2025 version, but in another, they point to the current book.
So what do you do if you're a player? Just guess.
You do exactly what we established in the first principle you ask the local layer. Before the game starts, your captain needs to ask the referees, "Hey, are we playing with face-off ejections tonight, or are you giving warnings?" You have to establish the local reality.
Okay, let's look at one more rulebook reality because this one is my favorite. It perfectly demonstrates how local logistics can completely override international rules. We need to talk about the trapezoid.
Oh, the trapezoid, right. So the trapezoid rule was implemented in the NHL and later the IIHF to restrict where a goaltender can play the puck. Behind the net, there is a marked area shaped like a trapezoid. The goaltender is only legally allowed to handle the puck behind the goal line if they stay within that specific painted area.
Okay.
If they wander out of the trapezoid into the corners to play the puck, it is an automatic delay of game penalty.
It was essentially designed to stop highly skilled goalies from acting like third defensemen and constantly clearing the puck out of the corners, which was slowing the game down. So it's a major tactical rule, but the sources explicitly note an exception for England and Wales.
Yes. Historically, under England ice hockey, this rule is simply not enforced. And the reason is fascinating. It is not because the English governing body disagrees with the tactical philosophy of the rule.
No.
No, it is because municipal rinks literally do not have the time, the budget, or the resources to scrape the ice and paint the trapezoid lines.
That is amazing. A massive international tactical rule is suspended entirely because the local rinks can't afford the paint. They're just like, we don't have the red paint, so the goalie can just roam free.
Precisely. The local logistics dictate the rule book. But here is where the mental model becomes critical. That suspension historically only applied to England and Wales. If you took your team on a road trip to Scotland, or if you played a university game governed by the BUIK, the British University's Ice Hockey Association, the rule might be fully enforced because their rinks had the lines painted.
So if it's your goalie, you have to coach them to play as though the rule binds them, just in case. And if it's the opposing goalie, as an attacker, you have to play in your dump and chase strategy, assuming they might aggressively come out into the corner to intercept the puck. You have to ask before you assume.
Which brings us to the ultimate synthesis of this first section. If we want to synthesize how the invisible matrix works, what are the core takeaways so far?
I'd say there are three massive pillars we've established. First, hockey is governed in four specific layers: international, national, regional, and local. Second, the local rink is your primary point of contact. They hold the answers to your schedule, your costs, and the specific application of the rules. Third, if you play outside North America, you are playing under IIHF rules, modified by local in-house rules, which means variable rink sizes, different penalty structures, and logistical quirks like the missing trapezoid. You can never, ever assume the NHL rulebook applies to your Tuesday night game.
Exactly. The foundational lesson is that hockey requires active, real-time local engagement. You have to ask questions. You have to find out what specific franchise reality you are operating under.
So if that is how the ice is governed, the next logical question is, how do you actually get permission to step onto it?
Hey.
Because as we transition into this next area, what we can call the graded on-ramp, the spoiler alert, is that you do not start by signing up for a game.
You absolutely do not. And this is a very common, very frustrating point of friction for adults trying to enter the sport. They watch a game, they get fired up, and they want to join a team immediately. They want to play hockey. But the sources outline a fundamental truth about learning this sport, which we can call the step zero principle.
Step zero.
Step zero is this: skating comes before hockey, always.
Yeah.
Skating is the ultimate sorting variable that dictates your level. It is not your ability to shoot a puck. It is not your hockey sense or your tactical understanding of the game.
It's just skating.
It is your physical ability to stop on both your inside and outside edges and your ability to skate backwards. If you cannot do those things dynamically and reflexively, you belong in a beginner skating group, regardless of how well you handle a stick in your driveway.
It makes complete sense when you think about the physics of the game. If you can't stop on a dime, you are a projectile. You are a hazard to yourself, and more importantly, you are a hazard to everyone else on the ice. The sources note that even the NHL Ezone Learn to Play programs strongly encourage participants to complete a dedicated Learn to Skate program before ever touching a hockey stick. And that applies equally, if not more so, to adults.
And practically speaking, public skating sessions are the cheapest ice time you will ever buy. Going to a public skate twice a week for a month before you spend a single dime on expensive hockey gear is the best, most efficient investment a beginner can make. You have to build the foundation before you build the house.
Okay, let's assume you've done step zero. You've put in the time at public skates. You can stop, you can turn, you can transition from forwards to backwards without falling over. What is the actual structural route onto the hockey ice? The sources identify four main entry routes for adults. Let's break them down mechanically, starting with Route 1, Learn to Play, or what is sometimes called Hockey 101.
This is arguably the best, most structured entry point. These programs are dedicated blocks of sessions that mix fundamental instruction with supervised scrimmages. The advantage here is twofold. First, You are on the ice with a qualified coach who is correcting your mechanics, and crucially, you are on the ice with other people who are also complete beginners.
Which takes away the embarrassment factor.
Exactly. The anxiety of messing up in front of experienced players is removed. The source cites the Adult Safe Hockey League, the ASHL in Canada, as a prime example. They offer structured blocks ranging from 4 to 23 sessions, usually ending each session with a 30-minute guided running time scrimmage.
Okay, route two is where I need you to translate some vocabulary for us, because these words get thrown around a lot by hockey players. And to an outsider, they all sound like the exact same thing. Stick and puck, drop in, and shinny. Unpack these terms, because showing up to the wrong one seems like a recipe for a really bad time.
It is absolutely vital to get these definitions right. Let's start with stick and puck. This is generally open ice reserved for individual practice. There are no teams formed, there are no referees, there is no game being played.
It's free practice.
Right. It is just individuals in helmets and gloves, sometimes full gear, depending on the rink's rules, skating around, shooting their own pucks at the nets, and working on their individual skills.
So if we go back to our sports analogies, stick and puck is like the driving range in golf.
Yeah.
You aren't playing a round of 18 holes. You're just standing there hitting your own bucket of balls.
That's a perfect analogy. You are there to refine mechanics. Now, contrast that with drop-in. Drop-in is a pickup game. You show up at a set time, you pay your fee at the door, you are given a light or dark jersey to divide the teams, and you play a full, continuous game with rolling shifts.
So it's an actual game.
Yes, you are usually required to wear full protective gear. There are rarely referees, and nobody is keeping track of standings or scores for a league table.
So drop-in is like a pickup basketball game at the local park. You're playing the actual game, but it's informal and unscheduled.
Correct. And then you have shinny. Shinny is a highly variable term. In much of Canada, it is just the standard colloquial word for outdoor or municipal pickup hockey. However, organized shinny sessions are often heavily modified for safety and accessibility.
Modified how?
They might be strictly no contact, they might explicitly prohibit goalies, they might mandate that you cannot lift the puck off the ice when shooting. It is designed to be a safer, lower intensity environment for a wider range of ages and skill levels.
But because these terms are conventions and not strict legal definitions, the sources emphasize that you cannot make assumptions based on the calendar name
Right,
tag.
exactly. You must always ask the rink desk three specific questions before paying for one of these sessions. What specific gear is required? What is the expected skill standard? And is there any contact allowed?
Got it. Stick and puck is the driving range, drop-in is the pickup game, shinny is the modified fun run. Now, route three for adults is joining a recreational league or utilizing a club trial. And the sources note a very specific structural mechanism that exists in England to facilitate this.
Yes. In England, the governing body understands that asking an adult beginner to commit to a full, expensive annual registration before they even know if they like the sport is a massive barrier to entry. So they offer specific short-term registrations. They have a trial registration, which lasts for exactly 28 days and strictly covers training sessions, only no games. A player can utilize a maximum of two of these trial registrations per year. They also offer a 10-week learn-to-play registration.
What is the actual mechanical purpose of these short-term registrations? Why not just let them play?
Insurance. These exist so that you can be legally insured by the NGB while you spend a month figuring out if you actually want to commit the time, money, and physical effort to the sport without having to buy the full annual package up front.
Okay, Route 4 isn't so much a route as it is a financial golden ticket. Let's talk about the goalie loophole. This is where the mechanics of hockey intersect with basic economics.
It is pure supply and demand. Goalies are scarce. At every single level of amateur hockey, there is a chronic shortage of human beings willing to buy incredibly expensive, heavy equipment, strap it on, and stand in front of frozen rubber discs flying at them at high speeds.
I mean, it sounds crazy when you put it like that.
Right. Because of this extreme scarcity, the economics of entry shift dramatically if you are willing to play the position.
The sources cite that ASHL Hockey 101 program again. And the numbers are wild. Out of 13 locations listed for the program, 11 of them priced the goaltender registration at exactly $0.
Zero. While the skaters in those exact same sessions were paying anywhere from $148 to over $780 for the block, goalies are heavily, sometimes entirely, subsidized by the skaters because of the scarcity of the position. Furthermore, because outfitting a goalie is so prohibitively expensive, I mean, a good set of pads alone can cost over $1,000. Local clubs frequently own club sets of goalie gear that they will loan out to beginners for free.
So they just give you the gear to get you in the net.
Exactly. They desperately need goalies to run functional practices and games, so they remove every possible financial barrier.
So if you want to play ice hockey on a budget and you have incredibly quick reflexes and a very high tolerance for physical discomfort, walk into the rink and tell them you want to be a goalie. They will roll out the red carpet. Now let's pivot from the adult entry routes to how children enter the sport, because the pathways there are very different, highly structured, and driven by developmental psychology.
For children, the national bodies have built very explicit, heavily marketed on-ramps. In the United States, you have programs like Try Hockey for Free, which operates at hundreds of rinks across the country. They provide loaner equipment and a specific legal waiver so that parents don't even need to purchase a USA Hockey membership just to let their kid try it for a day.
That's great.
In Canada, you have Esso Fun Days, specifically designed to grow the female game, and The First Shift, which is an incredible 6-week program that actually includes head-to-toe gear fitting and retention as part of the initial fee.
But once a child actually decides to join a club and play on a team, they get sorted into age classifications. 8U, 10U, 12U, meaning under 8, under 10, and so on. How exactly do they determine your age for these brackets? Because kids have birthdays 365 days a year, and the season spans across 2 calendar years.
This introduces the Decade 31st rule. In North America, players are placed into age categories based on exactly how old they will be on December 31st of the current calendar year. It is an absolute immovable cutoff.
Let's walk through an example to make sure we understand the mechanism. Let's say my kid's birthday is in late November. The hockey season starts in September.
Even though your child is, let's say, 7 years old when the season starts in September, because they will turn 8 before December 31st of that calendar year, they are classified based on the elder age.
Ah, I see.
They play in the bracket corresponding to their age on that specific date.
Okay, so that's the rigid North American structure. But the sources highlight a massive exception to this kind of rigidity when we look at England.
Yes. In England, the governing body sets a hard deadline for individual player registrations, usually January 31st of the playing season. After that date, you generally cannot register a new player for a team. But there is a massive structural exception, the U10 category. Players registering at the under 10 level can be registered at any time during the season, right up until the end.
What is the logic behind that? Why have a rigid rule for everyone else, but a totally open door for the youngest kids?
It is a deliberate acquisition strategy. At the U10 level, your primary goal as a governing body is not to run a highly competitive, balanced league. Your goal is simply to get as many bodies in the door as possible. You want to remove every conceivable barrier to entry.
Right.
If a 7-year-old wakes up in March, sees a hockey game on TV, and decides they want to play, you do not want the local club to have to say, "Sorry, you missed the January deadline. Come back in September." By September, that kid is playing soccer. You get them in the door immediately.
That brings up something that always fascinated me as a parent watching youth sports. If you go to a rink on a Saturday morning and watch the U7s or U9s play, they aren't using the full rink. They divide the ice in half, or they play cross ice widthwise. As an outside observer, it often feels like a compromise. You assume the rink is just overbooked, so they chop the ice in half to save money and get 2 games done at once. Or parents get frustrated, thinking their kid is being held back from playing the real game on the full sheet.
That is a very common and completely incorrect assumption. The mandate to play cross ice or half ice for the youngest age groups is not a logistical compromise. It is a deliberate, mathematically backed developmental strategy.
Explain the developmental math behind that. Why is it better?
Think about the physics of a 200-foot sheet of ice. If you put 10 7-year-olds on a full sheet, the game devolves instantly. The one kid who hit their growth spurt early or learned to skate faster will get the puck, skate in a straight line for 150 feet, and score.
Right.
The other 9 kids on the ice will spend the entire shift simply watching him skate away from them. They might touch the puck once a game.
They were essentially just doing cardio at that point.
Exactly.
Yeah.
But by shrinking the physical environment, by putting boards across the center red line and forcing them to play cross ice, you exponentially increase the density of the learning environment. You eliminate the ability to just skate in a straight line. Every player is constantly near the puck.
Oh, that makes total sense.
The number of puck touches per player skyrockets. Because the space is tight, they are forced to make decisions quicker. They have to learn to stop, pivot, and protect the puck rather than just skating fast. The small surface is the point. It forces skill development by restricting open space.
It's an incredible insight into how governing bodies actively design the learning environment. Okay, so we've established how to get on the ice, the developmental pathways, and the reality of skating as step zero. Let's transition logically into what happens after you sign up, because signing up isn't just about paying for ice time, it's about entering a legal framework. Let's move into our next major topic, bureaucracy as armor. We need to talk deeply about registration and sanctioning.
We mentioned earlier that paying your NGB fees buys your shield. We need to redefine what the word registration actually means in the context of hockey. When a beginner hears registration, they think they're just paying a club fee to get a jersey and ice time. That is false. When you register with a governing body, you are purchasing three highly specific things: insurance, safeguarding compliance, and competitive eligibility. Registration is your legal armor.
Let's start with the first piece of armor, insurance. And we need to explain how this gets complicated by what the sources call the calendar trap, because this catches a lot of beginners out financially.
Registration years for hockey do not follow the standard January to December calendar, and crucially, they do not run for a rolling 12 months from the day you hand over your credit card. They are fixed seasons. For example, USA hockey membership season runs from September 1st to August 31st. England ice hockey generally runs from August 1st to July 31st.
Okay, so let's walk through a scenario. Let's say I finish my public skating lessons in April. Mm-hmm. I am fired up. I go to the EIH portal in England, and I pay my full annual registration fee so I can start doing some club training. Does that fee cover me until next April?
Absolutely not. And this is the calendar trap. The sources point out that EIH explicitly states that pro rata discounts are not available. If you pay your full annual fee in April, you are only buying insurance coverage until July 31st of that same year. You are paying 100% of the price for roughly 3 months of coverage, and then you will have to pay the full fee all over again in August for the new season.
That is a brutal trap.
It is, which is why you must always ask what specific registration year you are buying into before you submit payment.
Okay, but let's push back on this whole concept of insurance for a second. Let's talk about sanctioned versus unsanctioned hockey. Because I hear these numbers, I see the fees, and I think, this is a racket.
Sure, people say that a lot.
Right, let's say my buddy Dave decides the official NGB leagues are way too expensive and bureaucratic.
Yeah.
Dave rents the local rink at 10 p.m. on a Tuesday. He texts 20 guys and says, hey, just bring 20 bucks cash, give it to me at the door, and we'll play a fun, informal game. It's cheap, it's easy, it's just a bunch of guys sweating. Why should I care if the NGB hasn't sanctioned Dave's league? I'm saving hundreds of dollars.
It's a very common argument, but if you step onto the ice in Dave's league, you need to understand the catastrophic risk you are taking. You are stepping onto the ice without a net. Let's look at the mechanics of the NGB insurance shield, using Hockey Canada as an example. Their insurance plan provides up to $20 million in general liability coverage per occurrence. It provides accidental medical and dental insurance. It provides specific payouts for death or dismemberment.
That's a lot of coverage.
That is a massive, highly negotiated safety net. But that net only deploys if you are playing in a sanctioned activity, meaning an activity officially recognized, governed, and officiated under the NGB's umbrella.
So in Dave's $20 league.
In Dave's league, you have zero NGB insurance. If you take a puck to the mouth and shatter four teeth, Dave is not paying your dental bill. You are paying entirely out of pocket. But the physical injury isn't even the biggest risk. Let's say you are skating hard, you lose an edge, and you accidentally crash into another player, severely injuring their spine. If they decide to sue you for negligence or medical costs, you do not have that $20 million liability shield defending you. You are personally, financially exposed.
That is terrifying. But the sources note that the consequences go beyond just the loss of the insurance shield. Mm. The governing bodies actively punish you for playing outside their ecosystem.
They do, because unsanctioned leagues threaten their structural integrity. Hockey Canada is incredibly blunt about this mechanism. If you choose to register your child in a non-sanctioned league and you do not return them to the sanctioned system by September 30th, your child will immediately lose all Hockey Canada membership privileges for the remainder of the entire season. You are locked out. They cannot play in official tournaments. They cannot play for their local club.
And what about adults? Does England take the same hardline stance?
The English perspective is just as harsh, if not more so. EIH regulations explicitly state that participating in unrecognized, unsanctioned competitions will result in a suspension from all authorized domestic or international competitions.
Wow.
Furthermore, it carries severe financial penalties for the player. They will even go after the rinks and the clubs, sanctioning affiliated clubs that dare to lend their ice time or facilities to unsanctioned games.
So the takeaway is absolute. It isn't just about saving 20 bucks at the door. If a game is not sanctioned, you are uninsured against catastrophic liability, and you are risking your eligibility to play the sport anywhere else in the country.
Precisely. Which brings us to the final component of your registration armor safeguarding. This is the structural mechanism designed to protect participants, specifically minors, from physical, emotional, and sexual abuse.
This has become a massive, non-negotiable part of modern sports administration.
It is the foundation of modern club operations. In the United States, this infrastructure is called SafeSport. It mandates that all employees, coaches, officials, and volunteers who have regular contact with minors must complete comprehensive annual training and undergo federal background checks. In Canada, they have a program called Respect in Sport. And what's interesting about the Canadian model is that it extends beyond the staff. It is a mandatory course for the
Wait,
parents.
the parents have to take a course.
Yes, it costs between $12 and $30, and at least one parent or primary caregiver must maintain active certification in this program for their child to even be eligible to step on the ice. It is designed to educate parents on appropriate sideline behavior, recognizing abuse, and understanding the pressure placed on young athletes.
And how does the UK handle this structural requirement? The sources mention a specific role that clubs must fill.
In the UK, the obligation sits very heavily on the organizational structure of the club itself. Every single affiliated club that has players under the age of 18 must have a designated safeguarding lead.
Let's dig into the mechanics of that. A designated safeguarding lead sounds like a title on a piece of paper. Does it actually change the power dynamics in a locker room?
It fundamentally changes them. Historically, in a sports club, the head coach held absolute power. They controlled ice time, roster spots, and discipline. If a coach crossed a line verbally abusing a player or exhibiting inappropriate behavior, players and parents were often terrified to report it because the person they would report it to was the coach or the coach's direct boss.
Right, there was no safe channel.
The designated safeguarding lead changes that architecture. It creates an independent, required channel. The DSL is specifically trained to handle these reports, and they have the authority to bypass the coaching staff entirely and report directly to the NGB or law enforcement. It breaks the monopoly of power in the locker room. Furthermore, coaches in the UK must hold specific licenses, which incorporate safeguarding checks, and they must physically display these licenses on a lanyard during games to prove they are compliant.
It's an incredible administrative apparatus designed entirely to protect the participants. So if we review the concepts we've covered in this section, registration is not just a fee for a jersey, it is your legal armor. It provides your liability shield against catastrophic lawsuits, it enforces safeguarding protocols that fundamentally alter the power dynamics to protect kids, and it maintains your competitive eligibility. The one question you must ask before handing Dave 20 bucks is this session sanctioned?
If the answer is no, you do not step on the ice. Period.
Perfect. Which transitions us naturally from the bureaucratic armor you buy to the physical armor you wear. Let's talk about the physical reality of hockey, gear, the specific rules regarding that gear, and what the sources highlight as the UK exception. Because this is where international differences literally become matters of life and death.
Hockey is an undeniably expensive sport to start. It requires an immense amount of specialized equipment. Historically, if you were to walk into a pro shop and attempt to outfit an adult beginner with full, brand new gear from head to toe, you could easily spend well over $1,200. Because of that massive financial barrier, there is a very necessary gear hierarchy that beginners need to understand a strict logic of what you should borrow versus what you must buy.
Let's establish the golden rule of gear.
The golden rule is this: borrow the shoulder pads, borrow the shin guards, borrow the elbow pads and the gloves, but never, under any circumstances, borrow or buy a secondhand helmet or goalie mask.
Let's debate this for a second, because if I'm a beginner looking at a $250 price tag for a new helmet, and my neighbor offers me his old one for 20 bucks, it's very tempting. If I look at my neighbor's helmet and the plastic shell is shiny, there are no visible cracks, and all the straps are intact, why wouldn't I use it? Isn't it just a piece of hard plastic?
This is a critical misunderstanding of how a helmet functions mechanically. The protection does not come primarily from the hard plastic outer shell. The primary concussive protection comes from the inner liner, the specialized foams inside the helmet. These foams are designed to absorb and dissipate the kinetic energy of an impact by compressing.
Okay,
right.
The problem is, you cannot see a crushed inner liner with the naked eye. If your neighbor took a massive hit into the boards 2 years ago, the foam in that specific spot may have compressed to absorb the blow, and it may never have fully expanded back to its original density. It is functionally dead foam.
Wow, I never thought of that.
Furthermore, you cannot see microscopic hairline fractures in a fiberglass or carbon fiber goalie mask shell. You have no idea what the impact history of a used helmet is. If you wear a hand-me-down helmet from an older sibling and you hit the ice, that compromised foam will not absorb the energy, and that energy will transfer directly into your skull. It is a concussive hazard. It is the one piece of equipment where you absolutely must spend new money.
That makes perfect sense when you explain the mechanics of the foam. The second imperative in the gear hierarchy is about skates. The sources insist that you must get them fitted in person. You can't just buy them online.
Buying your first pair of ice hockey skates online based on your street shoe size is a guaranteed disaster. A hockey skate is not a sneaker. It is a rigid boot designed to transfer power directly from your leg to a tiny steel edge. If it doesn't fit perfectly, you lose all mechanical advantage.
It's like trying to run a sprint wearing rain boots.
Exactly. When you go to a proper shop, they don't just measure the length of your foot. They measure the width, the instep, the volume, and then, crucially, they bake the skates. Modern skates are made of thermoformable materials. The shop puts them in a specialized oven, heats them up, you put them on, and as they cool, they mold precisely to the specific bumps and contours of your foot.
So it's totally custom fit.
Right. If you buy a loose boot online, your foot will slide around inside. You won't be able to engage your inside or outside edges, and you will incorrectly assume you have weak ankles. You don't have weak ankles. You have poorly fitted equipment that is fighting against your biomechanics.
Okay, we have our new helmet. We have our baked, custom-fitted skates. Now we need to discuss the most critical safety difference in the entire stack of source material. If you're listening to this deep dive in Britain, this next point is the most important part of the entire discussion. We need to talk about the British neck guard mandate.
This specific rule isolates exactly why relying on North American YouTube videos or blogs is physically dangerous. In North America, the rules regarding neck laceration protectors, neck guards, are relatively relaxed for older players. USA Hockey, for instance, heavily recommends them, but historically exempts adults from the mandate. Hockey Canada has requirements, but they have historically been narrow, often focusing on youth.
But the reality in Britain is completely different.
Radically different. In Britain, under the rules enforced by Ice Hockey UK, England Ice Hockey, and the university leagues, a neck laceration protector is absolutely mandatory for every single player at every single level, including adults, in all on-ice activities.
That phrasing is the kicker. All on ice activities.
Yes.
It doesn't just mean official league games.
It means everything. If you step on the ice for a formal practice, you wear it. If you step on the ice for an informal stick and puck session, you wear it. If you are an adult playing in a late night recreational league, you wear it. And here is where the British in-house rules diverge sharply and aggressively from the baseline IIHF rulebook. There's a no warning.
Explain that mechanical difference. How does the IIHF handle it versus Britain?
Under the standard IIHF rulebook, if an official notices a player isn't wearing a neck guard or is wearing it improperly, the rule dictates they give the team a warning first. They say, go fix it. The British in-house rules explicitly strip that warning mechanism away.
So what happens?
If you step onto the ice in Britain without a neck guard, or if you have deliberately modified it or folded it down so it isn't actually protecting your throat, you are penalized immediately. The officials will not warn you. They will simply assess the penalty.
It is a visceral reminder that the rules of the game adapt to the specific risk tolerance and the culture of the localized governing body. The NGB decides what is acceptable risk, and in the UK, an exposed neck is unacceptable.
Which is why you must know the rules of the ice you are standing on.
So, you are fully armored. You've got your fitted skates, your new helmet, your mandated neck guard. You step on the ice for your first real session. What does that first month actually feel like physically?
Yeah.
Because watching it on TV, they make it look effortless. They glide.
The gliding is an illusion created by world-class mechanics. For a beginner, the physical reality of learning to play hockey feels like intermittent maximal effort. And it is going to hurt in ways you aren't prepared for.
Intermittent maximal effort. I love that physiological description. Explain what that means for a beginner's body.
Hockey is not an endurance sport like a marathon, where you find a steady, moderate pace and hold it for 2 hours. It is a series of frantic, explosive sprints. A typical shift in a game is only 30 to 80 seconds long. You go all out, and then you sit on the bench and recover. But for a beginner, those first few shifts will feel significantly longer and more agonizing because you won't know how to pace yourself and you won't know the tactical moments to get off the ice.
When a beginner starts, what fails first? Is it their lungs or their legs?
It is almost always their legs, specifically the quadriceps and the hip adductors. The fundamental hockey stance requires you to be bent deeply at the knees with your chest up. You are loading those muscles in a state of constant isometric tension that normal walking or even running never demands.
So it's a totally new kind of strain.
Exactly. Groin injuries are the classic overuse issue for beginners because the adductor muscles simply aren't conditioned for the specific continuous lateral tension of pushing outwards on skate edges.
And the sources also mention the environmental shock, the thermal shock of the rink.
Yes, an ice rink is an extreme environment. When you first step out, your hands and feet will be freezing. But within 10 minutes, because you are wearing heavy, heavily insulated protective gear and exerting maximal effort, your core temperature will spike. You will finish the session absolutely soaked in sweat, breathing freezing air. It is a massive thermal roller coaster for your body to regulate.
I think the sources provide a really fantastic mental framing for beginners dealing with this physical shock. They say the learning curve of hockey is not a ramp, it is a staircase.
That is a vital mental model for psychological resilience. When you learn something like riding a bike, you gradually get a little better every day, a smooth ramp. Hockey doesn't work like that.
Yeah.
You will feel like you aren't improving at all for 3 weeks. You will feel stuck on a frustrating plateau where your legs burn and you keep falling on the same turn. And then suddenly your brain will subconsciously figure out the balance point of your outside edge, and you will jump up a step in ability instantly. It takes months of grueling effort to learn the absolute basics and years to feel truly comfortable. Expect the staircase and don't let the plateaus convince you to quit.
That is exactly the kind of insight a beginner needs to hold on to when their groin is screaming on week three. All right, we've covered the bureaucracy, the gear, and the physical toll. Let's move into our final area of focus, which is the culture of the sport, the unwritten rules, the etiquette, and understanding the systems. You have the right gear, you've legally registered, you've survived the physical shock of the first practice. How do you integrate into the community without infuriating your new teammates?
It starts long before you actually touch the ice. It starts with your watch. The concept of time is highly relative in hockey culture, and a beginner will offend people immediately if they apply normal societal standards of punctuality. In hockey, on time means you are fully dressed, armored, and ready to step over the boards onto the ice. It does not mean walking through the front doors of the building.
Yeah, so what are the actual numbers? How early is early?
Generally speaking, you need to arrive at the arena 45 to 60 minutes early for a game and 20 to 30 minutes early for a practice. And this isn't just an informal cultural quirk. Sometimes it is structurally mandated. In England, EIH explicitly mandates that coaches must arrive 60 minutes before a game. If you walk into a locker room 15 minutes before the puck drops, you are not just late. You are actively disrupting the coach's pregame talk, you are disrupting the team's mental routine, and you are disrespecting your teammates who plan their day to be there on time.
Let's talk about that locker room, the dressing room. In hockey, it is treated as a somewhat sacred space. What are the unwritten rules of the room?
Rule one, listen significantly more than you talk. Rule two is spatial awareness. Hockey gear bags are massive. Do not let your gear sprawl out and consume your neighbor's bench space. Keep it tucked tightly under the bench. And perhaps the most important unwritten rule of the dressing room, leave the goaltender alone right before ice time.
Why the goalie bubble?
Because the mental preparation required to deliberately stand in front of highly dense projectiles traveling at 80 miles an hour is completely different from the preparation of a skater. Many goalies enter a highly specific, focused mental state. Do not tap their pads. Do not ask them casual questions about their day. Let them prepare.
Okay, the team leaves the room and steps onto the ice. What are the cardinal sins of on-ice etiquette? I assume number one also involves the goaltender.
Without a doubt, the single fastest way to make an entire team, including your own teammate, furious with you is to shoot a puck at a goaltender who has not signaled that they are ready for you to shoot.
What are the mechanics of that signal? How does a beginner know the goalie is ready?
You look for three things. First, they must be looking directly at you. Second, they must be set in their athletic stance, not standing upright. Third, their stick must be firmly on the ice.
Makes sense.
If they are looking away, if they are talking to a coach, if they are adjusting a strap on their pad, or if they are taking a drink of water from their bottle on the net, do not shoot. Shooting at an unready goalie carries a massive, completely unnecessary injury risk, and it is considered the height of disrespect in the sport.
Cardinal sin number two happens during practice, and it involves something incredibly mundane standing in line, the drill line.
This confuses almost every beginner, but it ruins practices if it isn't followed. When a coach blows the whistle and draws a drill on the whiteboard, you need to form lines. The unwritten rules here are simple but absolute. First, join the shortest line. Do not just follow your friends to a longer line and unbalance the drill. Second, you start your repetition either when the coach blows the whistle or when the person ahead of you has reached the halfway point of the drill. But the most crucial part of the drill line is the finish.
You have to get out of the way.
Exactly. The most common infuriating beginner error is executing the drill, shooting the puck, and then stopping dead in your tracks right at the net to watch where the puck went or to reflect on what you did. You are now standing exactly where the next person in line needs to skate at full speed. You have to skate through the finish, curl towards the boards, and clear out immediately.
And what if I completely mess up the drill? Say I lose the puck in my skates on the first turn. Do I stop, pick it up, and apologize to the coach?
No. Never stop in the middle of the ice to apologize during a drill. If you do that, the person behind you will run into you, and you will cause a multiplayer pileup. If you lose the puck, leave it. Keep skating the pattern, clear the zone at the end, and rejoin the back of the line. Nobody on the ice cares that you messed up the drill. They only care if you block the flow of traffic.
That is a great rule for life, really. Keep moving and don't block traffic. Let's talk about etiquette during a drop-in game. We discussed those brutal 30 to 80 second shifts earlier. How does that work when there is no coach telling you when to get off the ice?
At a drop-in or pickup game, nobody is managing your ice time. It operates entirely on an honor system. Because it is exhausting, a beginner might think, oh, I'll just skate a little slower, conserve my energy, and that way I can stay out on the ice for 2 or 3 minutes at a time.
They think they are being efficient.
But they are actually being incredibly selfish. Taking a 90-second or 2-minute shift isn't you being efficient. It is you actively stealing ice time from the person who paid the same entry fee as you, who is sitting on the bench waiting for their turn. Keep your shifts short, skate hard, and change on the fly when the puck is moving away from your defensive zone so you don't trap your team.
Okay, before we move to our final synthesis, the sources provide a fantastic bonus insight for anyone who maybe doesn't want to play but just wants to watch hockey on TV and actually understand the geometry and the systems we've been talking about. Because right now, to an untrained eye, a hockey broadcast just looks like a swarm of bees following a black dot.
If you want to decode the systems of hockey to really see the matrix, the absolute first instruction an expert will give you is this: stop watching the puck.
Stop watching the puck. But the puck is the entire point of the game.
The puck is the focal point, yes, but it is not where the structure of the game is located. The broadcast camera naturally follows the puck, which gives the viewer tunnel vision. If you only watch the puck, you only see chaos. Instead, you need to force your eyes to look at the zones around the puck. You need to learn the directional vocabulary that players and coaches use.
Walk us through some of that vocabulary. What should we be looking for?
Start looking for specific areas of the ice. Understand what the half wall is, that is the section of the boards on the left and right sides, roughly level with the face-off dots. Look at the point, the area just inside the attacking blue line where the defensemen typically stand to keep the puck in the zone. Look at the high slot, the premium real estate right between the face-off circles in front of the net.
So you look at the space, not the object.
Yes, when you stop watching the puck and start watching the players moving through those specific zones away from the play, you start to see the defensive structures.
You start to see why a defenseman is standing in what looks like empty space, because they're actually cutting off a passing lane to the high slot.
Exactly. You see the invisible strings connecting the players. And it also helps explain those sudden chaotic moments that confuse beginners.
Like when there are suddenly only 4 players on the ice for each team instead of 5, and nobody on the broadcast explains why.
Right. If you understand the structure, you realize that's usually the result of coincidental penalties, where one player from each team committed an infraction at the exact same time, so neither team gets a power play, but both lose a man. Or understanding why a player suddenly bursts out of the penalty box, takes a long pass, and gets a breakaway on the goalie.
Ah, because the penalty expired.
Exactly. The broadcast rarely has time to explain the expiration of a penalty in real time. You just have to look at the penalty clock ticking down to zero and anticipate that a player is about to re-enter the system. Once you see the zones and the timing, the chaos becomes a highly choreographed, high-speed chess match.
Okay, we have covered an incredible amount of ground today. We have moved from the halls of international bureaucracy down to the exact foam inside a helmet. I want to do our final match resynthesis and bring this entire mental model together. If a listener only remembers the absolute core of this deep dive, how do we structure it?
I think we can organize this entire masterclass into five core principles of the invisible matrix. Principle one, governance, is local. The International Federation writes the baseline, and the national governing body provides your insurance and safeguarding structures. But your local rink dictates your Tuesday night reality. You must engage with the local franchise. And if you are in the UK, you must remember the June 2026 IHUK merger. The entire administrative landscape was rebuilt, and old information is useless.
Principle two, the path.
Principle two is that step zero is always skating. You cannot play hockey until you can stop on both edges. Once you can, you progress to a structured learn-to-play block. And the psychological rule of thumb is to always start one tier below where your ego tells you to start, because moving up a tier is easy and celebrated, while moving down a tier is painful and embarrassing.
Principle three, the bureaucracy.
Principle three is that registration is not just an entry fee. It is your legal, medical, and eligibility armor. You must be hyper aware of the calendar trap so you don't buy 3 months of insurance for the price of 12. And most importantly, you never, ever play in an unsanctioned league unless you are fully willing to risk millions of dollars in personal liability and face suspension from the sport.
Principle four, the gear.
Principle four is the golden rule of equipment. Borrow the pads, but never buy a used helmet or goalie mask because you cannot see compromised foam. Get your skates baked and fitted by a professional. And if you are playing anywhere in the UK, wear a neck guard at all times during all on-ice activities, because the officials will penalize you immediately without warning.
And finally, principle five, the culture.
Principle five is respect. Respect the locker room. Never shoot at an unready goalie. Keep your shifts short so you aren't stealing ice time. Clear out of the drill line immediately and accept the physical reality that your legs are going to burn and you will be climbing a frustrating staircase learning curve for the first 3 months.
So when we step back and look at the entire picture, what does this all mean? It means that learning to play ice hockey is fundamentally an exercise in local community building. You cannot just click a button on a national website, buy a stick online, and expect to be a hockey player. You have to put in the logistical work. You have to pick up the phone. You have to ask specific questions at a front desk. You have to understand the specific localized rules and dimensions of the franchise you are stepping into. You have to physically join a community.
And that reality leads me to a final concept for you to mull over as we end this deep dive. We spent a lot of time discussing how the NHL rules do not apply to your local rink and how varying rink widths, that massive 13-foot variance under IIHF rules, fundamentally change the geometry, the angles, and the tactical time a player has to react on the ice.
It changes the entire ecosystem of the game.
Exactly. So the next time you are watching an international tournament or even evaluating a professional player who just moved from a European league to a North American league, ask yourself this: how much of a player's raw talent or hockey IQ is actually inherent to them, and how much is simply them having perfectly subconsciously adapted to the exact dimensions and localized rules of the ice they happen to grow up on?
Wow. So when that beginner shows up and the diagnostic landscape gets murky, maybe it's because the player grew up mastering the angles of a 30-meter rink and now they're being judged on a 26-meter one.
Yeah.
The rules they internalize don't match the environment they're standing in.
Precisely. The environment fundamentally shapes the player. Change the geometry, change the rules, and you change the definition of talent.
What a fantastic, complex place to leave it. Thank you for taking this deep dive with us and for putting in the time to really understand the invisible matrix behind the game. We'll see you at the rink.